This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This morning, the Friday News Roundup begins an hour earlier. Diane Rehm will bring us the national and international hours at 10 and 11. But this hour, we'll cover this region's top news stories of the week. And, of course, the top story, the one on everyone's mind, sports fan or not, is the Carolina Panthers' impending appearance in Super Bowl 50 in Santa Clara, California on Sunday. We'll talk about other stories, too, but that's where we'll start with our panel of journalists. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here, along with Mary Newsom, Associate Director of the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute and the person in charge of PlanCharlotte.org. And we're also joined by Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning. Welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is our first attempt at this, so we'll just dive in with the Panthers. There's probably no bigger story, really, to start with than the Carolina Panthers in this region and Super Bowl 50 in Denver. Who knew, not in Denver, it's in Santa Clara, and they're playing against Denver, but who knew that we had two teams like that in the Carolinas? The one from Charlotte, the one from Denver. Who knew that? That's a joke.
We'll take your word for it, Mike.
What has the winning season, especially these two playoff games being played at the Bank of America Stadium at home, meant to Charlotte and to our economy? Anybody have any idea about that?
Well, it's been, I guess, really good for, you know, of course, civic pride, and you see a lot. You know, I see a lot more people than you typically have seen in the past, a lot more people wearing Panther stuff like
you
am right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've done stories at the Observer about how it's propelled the Panthers paraphernalia sales at their team store. I pass by the team store every morning on the way to our parking lot, which is kind of across the street from the stadium. And mm-hmm. I see a lot more cars there now than you used to. So.
And, you know, it's funny. As journalists, we often want to quantify things in a real tangible way. Economic impact is a very good one. It's very simple. It sounds clean. There should be, you know, a balance sheet that you can figure out. But it really doesn't work that way when it comes to sports. I came down here, as you know, Mike, I came down here from Baltimore 2 years ago. And in Baltimore, a city where until this year, the football team constantly made the playoffs, recently, you know, won the Super Bowl. It wasn't about dollars for the city. It was about spirit for the city. And I don't think that can be under or overestimated.
Do you feel that? Because I grew up in Washington at the height of when Sonny Jurgensen was playing for the Redskins. And
cue the sound of the NFL Films guy.
That's right. Yeah, Len Hathaway was doing play-by-play. I remember it well. But anyway, you could feel it. I mean, you could feel it in the city, Redskin fever, when they were headed toward the Super Bowl, when they were having a good season. Are we feeling that here now? What's it doing for the psyche of individuals, ordinary people who don't play football, if I'm mistaken?
Let me throw something in here. It's a little bit wonky, so I'm going to apologize in advance. But there's a guy named Robert Putnam who's famous for his theories on social capital. And a few years back, I chanced to be talking with him. And his recent research has found that the more diverse a city, the less social trust there is, which is maybe not a good thing. He didn't like those results. So we were talking about how do you overcome that, and he specifically mentioned sports as mm-hmm. a way that can bring people together beyond their differences. Now, he's in Cambridge in Boston, and they've got the Red Sox, which brings that fractured city together in amazing ways.
Yeah.
And I see the Panthers doing something of the same thing in Charlotte, bridging a lot of those boundaries that we're probably going to mention later in the show.
Well, we did a story, I think, yesterday on WFAE about Ron Rivera, if I'm not mistaken, because, you know, he has a background that is Hispanic and Latino. And it actually surprises me that people think of it that way, that we're still in 2016 thinking about ethnicity. That still matters?
Sure. Absolutely it does. In fact, I think it's a pretty common mistake for people to think that as time progresses that society progresses in that way. I mean, the reality of it is Ron Rivera is what, the second Latino coach to coach the Super Bowl? The second?
Yeah.
You know, you still have, for football fans, if I say that, you know, the Rooney rule, you'll understand exactly what that is. For those who don't know, it's a rule that the NFL has that minority candidates must be interviewed for head coaching jobs. The fact that that rule exists is proof that it needs to exist to get people to look beyond kind of the classic thing. And if you want to talk about a literal old boys club, the NFL head coaching ranks were the personification of that for a very long time. But to go back to Mary's point, you know, When I first came down, I'll use Baltimore again as an example. Driving through the streets of Baltimore, everybody had a Ravens flag or a Ravens sticker or something Ravens on their car. Come playoff time, literally every car, it seemed, had that. I didn't see that last year when, you know, the Panthers limped into the playoffs with a 7-9-1 record. But this year, you see flags on cars. You see flags on everything from high-end cars to cars that you're hoping can make it to the off-ramp before you get stuck behind them on the freeway. You see that kind of stuff everywhere. And you see people acknowledging each other simply for wearing the same team jersey. Now, I realize this does sound pie in the sky, but for this moment, for this reason, for exactly the reason that Mary was just talking about, whether you love football or not, you can find common ground in blue and black. And it really is kind of a fun thing to watch because it happens. And it happens for a brief moment. And you know what everybody's going to be doing on Sunday in this city?
You know, from the being a casual football fan, and quite honestly, this is the first year I've watched every single game. But I've watched every single game. There's something magic about this team at this moment in time, and I think Cam feels that. I think that the other players have acknowledged that, and Cam has said, this is our time. Let's enjoy it. We're vicariously experiencing that same thing, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it's not just that they've been winning. It's how they've been winning, especially as personified by Cam and the celebrations and the dab, which I think we're all kind of wishing would
over.
Go away by now.
Except for the team.
Yeah. But, I mean, they've just embodied this sort of spirit of joy and exuberance and just, you know, enjoying the moment and what they're doing. And I think we all kind of, you know, regardless of whether you're a football fan or not, you can kind of connect in with that and kind of feel that, and you know, kind of you wish if you're lucky, you feel a little of that at some point in your week or in your month or on your job somewhere. So, you know, it's a fun thing to connect into.
Eric, you brought up something a lot of people feel similarly, that a little dabble, do you? To quote Brill Cream, because most of us see Cam Newton as a gifted athlete. He's got a million-dollar smile. He loves what he does. He's helped galvanize this team into a winner. He gives footballs to little kids. I mean, what a great thing. And how come that hasn't happened before to this extent? It's amazing that he thought of that, and it's a cool thing to happen. But he's also known for being unapologetic about enjoying himself and celebrating himself and the team and the joy that he feels of playing the game. Why does that rub some people the wrong way?
Well, I think some people have kind of pointed out the whole – we've talked a little bit about how, the diversity and the lack of diversity at the upper echelons of sports and in the NFL – that's been true with the quarterback position, which is the glamour position of pro football. And you haven't had a whole lot of black quarterbacks. You've had kind of a trickle up to now, and you start to see a lot more now. But Cam is sort of he's a different guy than even a lot of the other black quarterbacks who have come before him.
Because
of this sort of, you know, he came into the league saying, I want to be an icon and an entertainer. Mm-hmm. And he really, that's kind of naturally his personality.
Where do you think that comes from? And where do you think his understanding of how to do that, which is clear that he has, comes from?
That's a good question. I kind of wish I knew the answer to that. I think some of it is just the nature of his personality. He's like this exuberant kind of overgrown big kid, and you know, a little kid with that little kid's joy trapped in a very large adult man,
which once again rubs people the wrong way in some cases. But I find it endearing. I love to watch people who take obvious joy in what they're doing, and the fact that he could pull off those pants says something to
pants, yeah.
There was a photo floating around online of Joe Namath in some kind of horrifically wild 70s bell bottoms that were every bit as loud. Yeah. Photo was black and white, though.
Yeah, and Joe, you know, that's Broadway Joe when he was getting the name. And you know, I will say this, though. I think what's interesting here is the attention that's coming on Cam Newton. We were talking about this in the newsroom yesterday. The attention that's now on Cam Newton has him being portrayed in many ways on a national sense as the villain, as the bad guy, as something just quite not right. And, you know, I think there's something that we do here in America as a culture, and it gets boiled down into big games like the Super Bowl, which is we really like clearly defined lines of people. Mm-hmm. We like a good guy and we like the bad guy. We like, you know, the team that is representing America and the team that's, you know, these guys are a little rebellious. We love the idea of rebel. It's not necessarily bad in terms of, you know, they're the evil villains, but we love to have that kind of boogeyman feel.
But isn't that America?
Yeah, it is. And but, I mean,
so I've heard a rumor that we're on the verge of becoming America's team, taking that mantle away from the Dallas Cowboys.
Not going to happen, especially since most people look. We're a team. The Carolina Panthers represent two states that, you know, most Americans couldn't find Charlotte on a map. I hate to say it, but it's true.
That's true.
The reality of it is, though, I think that Cam Newton is getting the attention, the scrutiny, really, that he's getting right now because the Denver Broncos have been around for a very long time, and everybody knows they've won multiple Super Bowls. Yeah. They had this epic quarterback in John Elway in the past. They've got, you know, one of the greatest quarterbacks who ever played, who may play his last game for the Broncos on Sunday, and that's Peyton Manning. So, boy, isn't it easy for these sports writers who are cooped up in Santa Clara for two straight weeks without a game to play, looking for stories, to suddenly start pointing their pens and their cameras and, you know, typing away about the Carolina Panthers, because the Carolina Panthers are the new guys. Yeah. That's why they're being cast.
We might ruin Peyton Manning's exit.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And that would be a bad thing in many people's minds.
That's exactly right.
I want to throw in something really quick about the finding Charlotte on a map, because I do believe that's still true. Most Americans can't find Chicago on a map, much less Charlotte. But I just spent a week in a whole other state in the far northwest, skiing, riding in ski lifts with total strangers. And, you know, so we're chatting. Where are you from? I'm from Charlotte. And I began saying it deliberately to see if they would say, now, where is that again? They all knew.
Uh-huh.
Now, that is not a data point, but it's an interesting anecdotal
evidence.
Well,
nobody confused it with Charleston?
No.
I was speaking to some folks at the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority the other day about this season and about these nationally televised playoff games, which showed Charlotte by day and night in these beauty shots that they show at the commercial breaks. And they were saying that the impact of all this will be enormous, because not only will people know who we are, there won't be any more confusion. They know what we look like, and that we have an NFL team, and that this is a place to reckon with. Do you think that's true?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think it's making a difference. And there's other things making a difference, too, but I do think this is a big part of it. 10-year-old kids now know where Charlotte is.
Do you think it's unfortunate that we're having this conversation? It seems like a little navel-gazing and a little, you know, local flag-waving here that, oh, gee, we have a team. Aren't we great? People will think we're great. Isn't that a little parochial?
Well, that's what we do. I mean, that's who we are. That's Charlotte. We're so worried that people don't know who we are.
We're a wannabe place. We want to be. And does this make us? Are we being now?
Well, we'll certainly get more attention. Whether or not you're being, there's so many factors that go into something like that. But the reality of it is look, if the Panthers win the Super Bowl on Sunday, this is going to be home to a world championship. If they have a follow-up season that's fantastic, we start going down, at least in the sports world, as a team that knows what they're doing. People do actually pay attention to that.
There are other topics that we'll be talking about in the news with regard to our weekly news roundup. We'll get to them eventually. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAU. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Ballet's Innovative Works, a dance performance with new contemporary ballets, plus a reception with the artists after the show, now through February 20th at the Center for Dance uptown. Tickets at charlotteballet.org. Well, for the second time in franchise history, the Carolina Panthers and the Super Bowl have intersected. The Panthers' first appearance there was a surprise to most of the country, but this time the team has built awareness through a pattern of wins week after week all season long, with only one loss. However, a lot of people will be discovering them for the very first time on Sunday. So what does this exposure on a worldwide stage mean for the team, for its stars, for Charlotte? We get a morning after report from the Bay Area on this program Monday morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. As the New Hampshire primary looms, Republicans brawl over tactics used in Iowa. The FBI joins the Flint drinking water investigation, and President Obama calls for religious tolerance at his first mosque visit.
Join the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. You're listening to the very first ever weekly news roundup.
From us.
Our regional weekly news roundup. The national and international hours will follow at 10 and 11. Tom Bullock is here, reporter for WFAE News. Mary Newsom, associate director of the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. And Eric Frazier, an editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. We will move beyond the Panthers in a second. But we had a scare this season when Cam Newton had a car accident in which he was injured. And to this day, we discover, he still wears his hospital bracelet from that accident. And Coach Rivera was asked about that at a press conference on Wednesday. Here's what he said.
You know, what was interesting was the day he had the accident, I went down to the hospital to visit with him. And just listening to him talk about, you know, his experience, and you could see that there was something that really kind of, you know, made him realize, you know, the frailties of life. And I think it really did help him as he's gone forward. We've seen it because from that point on, you know, he has most certainly been just improving and getting better and better. I think there's been a lot of things in his life that have changed him and I think has really helped him as he's gone through this. And most notably, the most recent one obviously has been the birth of his son. He seems to have really grasped fatherhood very well. And, you know, I just think it's part of his growth, is who he's becoming as a football player, but more importantly, who he's becoming as a young man.
There's clearly a difference in the Cam Newton of this season and the Cam Newton of previous seasons. Those are the reasons, you think?
I like that explanation, just frankly. I hope that is what happened. Because the difference between him previously and now really is pretty startling. I mean, he was always a good quarterback. Now, all of a sudden, he's a great quarterback. Mm-hmm. And if that transformation happened because he, you know, that sort of that feeling that young people have that they're invulnerable and I'm going to live forever, got that veil got pierced for him in that wreck, and he suddenly, you know, everything snaps into focus and he becomes, you know, a lot harder, studier and worker and preparer and, you know, paying more attention to all the details of his job. I like that. I hope. You know, it seems plausible, and I hope that is what happened.
There are other players on this team that are making significant contributions, and we have a defense that makes touchdowns as well as an offense that does that. And the Observer did a story, I think it was yesterday, comparing the styles, the personal and professional styles of Cam Newton and Luke Kuechly. Cam's the flamboyant, outgoing guy, and Kuechly is kind of withdrawn, but they both do all this homework and evidently have a tremendous amount of respect for each other. And that's a theme that runs through the team, evidently, which can't help but contribute to this winning season, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, you hear a lot about drama in sports. You hear a lot about locker room fights, guys that are, you know, locker room cancers because they're just all about themselves or they don't play – literally, they don't play well with others. It's easy for some people to just kind of get this arrogance about them because, let's face it, NFL players get to this level based on a simple thing, talent. Most of them are young. Most of them have not really experienced what I would call real life because they literally have been known for one thing and they are incredibly good at that thing. If you can wipe away the drama that kind of, you know, hubris or arrogance or whatever you want to call it brings, and you start getting people to do the blue-collar, workman-like, you know, traits of a team, mm-hmm. It doesn't matter whether you're playing football or you're working in an office. That's the kind of thing that can actually help everybody get better.
Neither Denver nor Charlotte are the biggest cities in the country, which I probably irks a lot of the bigger cities in the country who are not playing on Sunday. But Wells Fargo Securities recently wrote an article about this Super Bowl matchup, saying that aside from both Denver and Charlotte having something to cheer about, the two teams' home cities also rank among the most vibrant economies in the country, with a broad mix of industries producing strong job growth and encouraging a wave of immigration. Talk about that, Mary.
I think they're right. I think if you are living in Charlotte and looking at the numbers, the vibrant economy is very vibrant in some spots and not at all vibrant in other spots. We haven't done a particularly good job of spreading the wealth or trickling it down or whatever you want to call it. I don't know that much about Denver's economy, but I do know that both of them are regional cities. Charlotte is a regional city. When we talk about Charlotte, we should be envisioning not just downtown Charlotte but not just Ballantyne, but Fort Mill and Gastonia and Belmont and Kannapolis and all of those other cities in the region. And some of those are really hurting.
And yet the team is called the Carolina Panthers. So this pride or this thrill that we're feeling as this team goes to the Super Bowl spreads out beyond Charlotte. We should not forget that. But that begs the question, when we play in the Super Bowl, and there's only a limited amount of time to talk about where these teams come from, everybody knows Denver. Mm-hmm. And that team is stamped with Denver on it. Mm-hmm. We're stamped with Carolinas. And even my brother doesn't know where we are on the map. So...
Well,
I'm not kidding.
I think we could probably do a whole show, and I'm not suggesting that we do this. We could probably do a whole show on the tensions between Charlotte and its impression of itself and the rest of the region and the rest of North Carolina.
But I guess my question was going to be, looking back, should we have called it, should Jerry Richardson have called it, and I know why he didn't, but should he have called it the Charlotte Panthers? Or would that have diminished it in some way?
Yeah, it's marketing. I mean, let's face it. He picked Carolina because it allows you to expand to the South. And that would literally have limited it more, let alone Raleigh.
So, any predictions on the outcome? In the interest of full disclosure, we have two people here, Eric Frazier and Tom Bullock, sitting in Panther jerseys. So you guys are not unbiased, which really disappoints me. any predictions on the outcome of the game on Sunday?
Denver has a crazy good defense. My sister lives in Denver. My dad has been a lifelong Denver Broncos fan. I'm from not far from there. So there's this fun little tension in terms of bets inside the family. My guess is it's going to be a heck of a game. I think it's going to be Carolina 23, Denver 17.
Eric?
I like the end result. I tend to agree. I think the Panthers, just on paper and based on how they've played, how both teams have played so far this year, I think the Panthers are, people are correct to favor the Panthers, but I think maybe 27-20.
I won't ask you, Mary, for a prediction because I know you're not a big follower of football, but I will ask you, if we lose this game, we won't, of course, but if we lose this game, what will the mood be here on Sunday night, Monday morning?
I don't think people will be really bummed, but they'll move on with their lives. And there's always another season, which is one of the great things about sports.
Let's move on to other topics here. We spent a lot of time on the Panthers because they deserve it. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board, after waiting significantly, more than a year, a really long time after the departure of former Superintendent Heath Morrison, has finally decided that they should begin a search for a replacement. But the Observer asked in the headline to Astoria this week, I think, about this, has CMS Board run out its clock on that search? Have they, Eric?
Well, they've kind of painted themselves a little bit into a corner by not coming out earlier than they have and, you know, sort of definitively said whether they want to go ahead and start a search or do they want to, you know, they've let Ann Clark's contract, I believe, is up at the end of July.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so they've waited and waited and waited until they've left themselves with just, 6 months to do a search, and searches usually for a superintendent usually take about a year.
Well, that article was written, I think, before a Saturday meeting of the school board on this issue, and the Observer called it make or break time. Yet earlier this week, after the meeting, WFAE reported that the board still can't decide when to launch this search. What's going on here? Is this a black and white split on the school board? Is that what this is all about?
I think if you look at the split, you see black faces and white faces, and I think that's probably not an accident, but I think it goes back deeper than that. I think it goes back to the school closings that took place under Peter Gorman, who closed a bunch of schools and what?
And Ann Clark has gotten a lot of blame for that.
Ann Clark has gotten blame for that. And if you're the deputy superintendent, you do what the boss tells you regardless of what you really feel. So who knows? That was a very, very bitter time in Charlotte, and people are still angry about it. And the schools that were closed were predominantly black schools.
Right.
So is it a black issue or a white issue? Who knows? I do think that any time you do a search, a national search, if you've got a strong in-house candidate or if there's a belief that the local people may want to hire someone who's already there, you're going to diminish the pool of potential candidates pretty significantly.
But she clearly, I think, wants to retire, and she extended her stay at the request of the school board to take this position in an interim basis. She had an 18-month contract, which, as Eric said, takes you to July. So if she really doesn't want to stay, why drag your feet on picking a new person?
Well, she has said that she'll stick it out for another year if they are still doing the search. And to clarify exactly what happened at that Saturday meeting, they agreed that they should do a search.
Okay.
No search firm has been hired.
Right.
They haven't set a timetable. They've done nothing but agree to something that they agreed to when Heath Morrison left under, let's just call it a cloud, back quite a while now. I mean, they've literally, as they campaigned, I mean, you know, some school board members were up for election last year. They all said that the community deserves to have us have a search, that Ann Clark's position should not be a fait accompli. They haven't done anything yet, and you've got these major issues that they want to take up, where some members say, we can't do all of this. We can't talk about student assignment and do a superintendent search. And others say, well, we've promised a search. We should do a search. And also, more importantly, if we're going to make these major changes like student assignment, we really should have a superintendent picked and in place.
And Mary McRae essentially says the board does, in fact, have the ability to multitask.
As to the myth that the board cannot do a superintendent search, student assignment, and carry out its responsibilities at the same time, I say that is hogwash. This board and boards before us throughout its history has handled heavier loads than this. And as the board of directors for a billion-dollar organization such as ours, if we can't do more than one thing at a time, not only should we be ashamed, but the community should demand new representation.
That's school board chairperson Mary McRae talking about all of this. If they extend Ann Clark's contract, she will have had the tenure at the top of the heap for as long as many traditionally hired superintendents hold the job. They don't stay in the jobs very long. But the Observer pointed out that the superintendent shuffle plays out in a spring-to-spring cycle nationwide, and it generally takes about a year to find replacements, and our board is late to the game. Can this board, at this stage, find a quality superintendent by July or even by next July?
I think the odds against that are pretty long. You've got others. You know, you've got Greensboro, and you know they're already down the road with their search, and you'd like to think that you know the top tier superintendent candidates would tend to pick Charlotte, the bigger, probably higher paying district, over Greensboro. But you know, Greensboro is already out there, and so we'll be sort of coming behind them and a number of other school systems around the country, and I also think that. The question of whether or not you should have a superintendent in place to handle this, what's going to be a pretty tumultuous, controversial situation with student assignment, you're going to, if the new superintendent handles that, that new superintendent is going to lose a lot of that honeymoon luster and shine that
very
the new
quickly.
Superintendent comes in with.
Are they waiting for that? What's holding that up, that pupil assignment issue? And how long do they have before they have to actually start moving on this if they want to implement something?
They haven't set themselves a timetable. They could. I mean, right now they have an online survey that would be reminiscent of people taking the SAT or any bubble test. I actually took it yesterday just out of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And the questions are multiple choice. You know, how would you rate this? What is your priorities? There's no engagement there. There's no kind of classic actually hearing people's arguments. It all boils down to data points. And that's one of the things. Like, I am not one of these people that think that a superintendent is the superstar of a school system. I think data has shown time and again that what really matters are great principals and teachers. You know, that it's a diffuse enough system that you can have these pockets of greatness for a reason, and that's largely because of the local principal and good teachers. But you still need a superintendent with an overall vision to implement something as controversial as student assignment. And let's face it, if you were a superintendent candidate thinking about coming to Charlotte, would you want to go to a place where the board can't seem to decide whether or not to do a search, where you have this implementation of something incredibly controversial that you may have no hand in crafting, and you've got to deal with the ramifications because suddenly you become the public face of that move? Would you want to come here?
Or you have to hit the ground running and learn the system so well that you can do the school assignment, the people assignment yourself.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are a lot of arguments as to why Ann Clark would be a good person for this role. The problem with what the school board has done is they have not let Ann Clark stand as a candidate because they keep going back and forth on whether or not they should look for a candidate. It hasn't helped Ann Clark's case to the community.
So that's not the only controversy in Charlotte. The other one will happen again on Monday night when the city council meets. We talked about this earlier in the week at some length. At the behest of Charlotte's new mayor, Jennifer Roberts, the Charlotte City Council is going to reconsider the controversial non-discrimination ordinance that met with some of the most fervent protests in recent history back when it was defeated in March. This week, at the urging of the council, the Community Relations Committee and others held a forum in which actors portrayed people on both sides of the issue, and then attendees broke up into groups to talk about what they saw and they heard. Tom, you were there. How did that go?
On Monday, I told you that this could go really, really hokey, that it could feel a little bit like middle schoolers trying to tackle a really complicated issue, because let's face it, it's a pretty unorthodox move. Honestly, Mike, it was pretty good. You know, it all hinged on whether the audience members, there were some 250 people in the crowd, they didn't have enough seats for everyone. It all hinged on whether they were willing to sit down and talk, actually have a conversation about this. And they did. I mean, there was this incredible moment where everybody, after the actors got up and spoke or, you know, had their dialogue that they had these little monologues they did. Mm-hmm. Audience members broke up into circles, probably about 12, just turned their chairs around like, you know, in a big little circle, and they sat there and talked. Now, I couldn't find anybody who had their mind changed. I couldn't find anybody who thought differently about the issue. But sometimes it's just good to have the community actually talk to each other.
But the idea of using actors in this case, I understood that the idea was that they felt that this would diffuse the conversation.
Create a safe space, yeah.
Because these actors would not actually be the people that they're talking about. They would be taking on a role. But in one of the actors, Shay Busick, is in fact a transgendered male actor. Mm-hmm. And he played a transgendered person in this and went a little bit off script. Let's just play that first clip right here.
Everybody keeps talking about their kids. I am your kid. And this is really hard. If you were my parents, I'm sure, even though deep down you might be horribly upset with who I am or what I am, you might not approve of me, you would still want me to be safe. Deep down, I think every parent wants that.
That's an actor, a transgender actor, portraying a transgender person. We'll come back and talk about that, and we'll talk about the impact of, because they went off script evidently, we'll talk about the impact of that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru. Gastonia test drives are available for the new 2016 Crosstrek SUV with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And Donald Hack Diamonds, hosting a Philip Gavriel trunk show in celebration of Valentine's Day, Wednesday, February 10th through Friday, February 12th, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and next Saturday, 10 a.m. till 4, now at Moorcroft Village, South Park. Details at DonaldHack.com. As the New Hampshire primary looms, Republicans brawl over tactics used in the Iowa caucuses. The FBI is joining the Flint drinking water investigation. And President Obama calls for religious tolerance at his first mosque visit. Those are just some of the topics they'll be talking about in the national hour of the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. The international follows at 11, and we will continue with our regional wrap-up in just a moment. Stay with us.
Crossing the border to get to high school from Mexico to the U.S. is just part of life for a lot of students in El Paso.
If you want to succeed and if you want to have, a life, you could say, you have to go for it and you have to get an education because it's important to get one.
Yeah, it is. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back to El Paso for our series, My Economy, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our regional news roundup today with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer. He's an editorial writer there, and Mary Newsom, associate director of the UNC Charlotte Urban League. We just heard from Shay Busick, an actor, a transgender male actor. That's a woman who has become a male. Is that correct?
Correct.
And they portrayed a transgendered person in that clip that we just heard and evidently went off script. How so?
Well, I spoke with Willie Ratchford, who does the Charlotte Mecklenburg Community Outreach here. He was the one, they were the group, I should say, that helped put this on. And he said that every vignette, and there were four vignettes that night, two business leaders, one for and against the proposed changes, mm-hmm. a mother who was afraid to send their children into a restroom because there were fears about, assault or molestation, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then the views of a transgender person. And he said that they were going to get all of their source material from the debate that happened last March. It was a very, very long, interesting night where people spoke before the city council. The city council that night, by the way, voted down that provision, expanding the provision 6-5. So the actors were all given transcripts and shown footage of the actual debate. Shay Busick was like, I watched the videos and she said, I'm not going to do this. I'm not just going to, parrot what somebody else said. I'm going to speak. She told me, I'm going to speak from the heart. I'm going to share my own experience. That's how she went off script.
And here's what she said about that.
I watched the opposition videos from the past ordinances that have been passed or the past ordinance meetings that they've had. And I just went with my heart. What I know, I thought about my parents and what they would want to be represented for them. And I thought about the other people in my community that are dying or getting beat up because nobody's protecting them. And I just wanted to create a safe space. So that's what I brought. I that's how I put it together. It was just my own personal response and something that came from my head and other people's stories.
And let me correct myself. That's what he said about why he chose to go off script. And not to sound cold or indelicate here, but what's the point of having actors do this? Why not have real people do this? This is a real issue that affects real people.
Well, the planner said it was to present the arguments that they already know is out there and allow people to just listen to the arguments and then get to that group discussion phase.
And once again, in March, this all came down to bathrooms. Did it come down to bathrooms again?
Certainly it was a key focus, but people were trying to at least talk about other issues mm-hmm. here, talk about fairness, talk about safety, talk about their concerns. I would say that meeting was really more about the fears from both camps mm-hmm. and at least expressing, airing those fears publicly.
And the other issues here, and we talked about this on Monday when we had Representative Bishop on and Chris Scrow from Equality NC, and you were on the program as well. Those other issues include the fact that this really doesn't affect business hiring practices. It affects business interaction with customers. You still don't have, under these ordinances, if they were to pass, you still don't have to, as a business, hire a gay person or a transgender person. But you can't refuse service to them. If you're a restaurant or you're a hotel, you have to open your doors to them. Is anybody talking about that?
All I hear is bathrooms. It just hits somewhere deep in people's psyches that they feel vulnerable. They feel their mm-hmm. kids are vulnerable. And one of the things that has been somewhat ironic about this whole conversation, if you remember back to the Equal Rights Amendment, mm-hmm. the one that never passed that would have given women equal standing under the Constitution, the two arguments that were against it that had the most resonance were, number one, if you pass this, women will be coming home from wars in body bags. Well, guess what?
They are.
And if you pass this, we'll have unisex bathrooms. Well, guess what? I mean, I go into places all the time that have one bathroom that's used by two people. It's the bathrooms that freak people out. I don't know why. I mean, maybe guys don't realize, but in women's restrooms, there are stalls with doors.
And they're nicer.
I hear they're nicer.
We all know, let's move on to voter ID, because we all know that the legislature passed these voter ID laws, and then a large segment of the population saw that as an attempt to disenfranchise a certain segment of voters. That case has been in federal court now for over a year, and a judge in Winston-Salem is about to rule. So what case has the Justice Department been making about these laws? I'm not sure who to ask that question of. Aaron?
Well, I know the case that the NAACP has been making, mm-hmm. you know, throughout all this, is that these laws were passed as a thinly disguised or badly disguised attempt to tamp down minority voting. And when you look at the fact that the experts say that the most likely place where you get voter fraud is absentee voting, but that was not what these laws addressed at all, it is a fair question.
And in fact, didn't the legislature kind of blunt the argument a little bit that the Justice Department might have made at this trial by changing the law a little bit, softening the law a little bit, opening it up to making it easier for people to find and get IDs?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. And the judge actually even questioned why it was that move was made. And, you know, there's all kinds of questions about why exactly they did that. There were some interesting emails that were reported by the News and Observer in Raleigh that talk about, lawmakers saying why they didn't want to pass these watered down provisions on the floor, because that bill just moved like that. It was mm-hmm. lightning quick. There was no real floor debate. It just happened. And it's because the emails, at least, according to the News and Observer, reported that people, the lawmakers, were not interested in giving ammunition to the U.S. Justice Department's case. Now, that is pretty telling, at least in terms of some kind of intent. I'm not going to go so far to say that that is the intent of the original law. I'll leave that for people to decide. But it does show that they were aware or worried that the voter ID provisions were not going to stand.
And yet, correct me if I'm wrong, somebody in the legislature said it was simply a difference of opinion between the Senate and the House.
That goes back to the original bill. And you're correct, because the original bill that was passed by the House did not have the extreme measures that the U.S. Justice Department and the NAACP say that you now have after the Senate had its rollout.
When can we expect a ruling on this?
Well, the big date is obviously March 15th. That's when North Carolina has its primary. But in reality, the judge said it'll be weeks. And he is not feeling any pressure to confine to that March primary here in North Carolina.
So what happens if the judge decides to strike this down, or if he decides to maintain it?
Then he decides to maintain it, or he strikes it down. If it strikes down, we go back to what we've known up to this point, because the primary will be the first time the voter ID is used under these provisions in North Carolina. And if it holds, then we all need to start paying attention to the videos that the State Department or
And I think there's been some controversy about how the state mm-hmm. how the State Board of Elections has been portraying the changes.
Absolutely.
If you think you need a voter ID and you don't have one, you don't even show up. And the change has been that if you don't have a voter ID and you show up, you can make some kind of a statement and say, well, I had a hard time getting one. But how many people are going to know that, I think, is the discussion.
If the judge upholds it, are we likely to see other states pass similar laws quickly?
I would think that probably would embolden, other states.
I'm going to disagree with that just a little bit, because I think he's just a district judge. And other states have already a lot of other states have passed similar laws. And if the appeals court says, it's okay, then I think that's going to be the trigger for any other states that might be lurking out there that want to do something like this.
The Iowa caucuses were Tuesday. Ted Cruz was the big winner on the Republican side, with Donald Trump coming in second and demanding a recount. Marco Rubio leading the field of more traditional GOP candidates, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Virtual tie there on the Democratic mm-hmm. side. On Tuesday, New Hampshire voters decide, and then I think it's on to South Carolina,
if
I'm not mistaken. Will South Carolina voters be taking their cues from what has happened in Iowa and what it might happen on Tuesday in New Hampshire? Or will they be a completely different creature unto themselves?
Well, it seems, I guess, if the past is any prologue, it seems like South Carolina does not usually go the way Iowa goes, or am I?
No, Eric, you're exactly right. I mean, Iowa and New Hampshire have a pretty hit or miss record of picking who's going to be the party nominee. South Carolina is surprisingly accurate. If you look at the Republican side, they have picked the eventual Republican nominee every year except for 2012, and it was Newt Gingrich. And obviously Newt Gingrich ended up fizzling out.
Who's running ahead right now in South Carolina? Do you know?
Donald Trump.
And Bush is supposed to be fairly strong, at least by Bush 2016 standards.
And you bring up a really interesting point, and I love this number. My favorite thing about Iowa, you know, there's all kind of data points that we all have now, but my favorite thing is Bush's $100 million super PAC called Right to Rise has been the big ad machine for his campaign in Iowa, New Hampshire, and in South Carolina. But they are so focused on South Carolina that they have what was this? As of January, it was the last week in January when we had all the data from Kantar Media, who tracks all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And the Center for Public Integrity put it out. And what was fascinating to me is that Right to Rise had aired more ads in South Carolina by the end of January than they had in New Hampshire. And why is that important? Number one, Bush said it all depends on New Hampshire, so you would think they would focus there. They are not. And number two, it tells you that they're really hoping for a South Carolina win, because he is not going to win New Hampshire. He got 2.8% of the vote in Iowa, which is terrible. And with the reputation that South Carolina has as to picking the nominee, they're really hoping that they can get a strong showing or even win to justify that campaign continuing.
But it's very conservative in South Carolina, and there are a lot of evangelicals in South Carolina. And Ted Cruz, the evangelical candidate, really, won in Iowa. Mm-hmm. Will he not? Don't you think he'll do very well in South Carolina?
He'll do better in South Carolina than he will in New Hampshire, likely. But I do think you're right, Tom, in that it does look like South Carolina is Jeff Bush.
One of those Bushes.
It's the Bush last stand.
I think South Carolina Republicans have been so Republican for so long that they do tend to be more quote unquote establishment mm-hmm. Republicans.
I think that South Carolina is a better representation, in my opinion, of the actual American electorate for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's a far more diverse state. I mean, Iowa is 91% white. New Hampshire is 94% white. South Carolina is a better reflection of the general electorate. But also with the Republicans, it's really fascinating because you do have a whole lot of evangelicals. You do have a whole lot of that establishment lane. Mm-hmm. But you also have a lot of the fence hawks and a lot of other subgroups, social conservatives, all sorts of stuff. So it's not as easy to boil down as like Iowa is for evangelicals and New Hampshire is for establishment.
Jim Morrill, the Observer's political reporter, reported on one Jeb Bush supporter in Florence, South Carolina, as saying that South Carolina is Bush's firewall. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
I think it's
that's where the hemorrhaging stops.
Yeah,
that's where the base begins.
That's what they hope anyway. Okay. And I think on the Democratic side, you see sort of the same thing. It's Hillary Clinton's firewall, too, with African-American voters.
This is more of a national thing, but I was watching Showtime is doing a series called The Circus, Inside the Greatest Political Show on Earth, which runs, I think, every week, and it's a 30-minute show. And they were saying that the Republicans have a real problem, but that the four moderates are all splitting the moderate vote, mm-hmm. making it impossible for a moderate to overtake Trump or Cruz, and that the four moderates, Rubio, Christie, Bush, and Kasich, face a prisoner's dilemma. One of them must be allowed to emerge, and the other three have to die in order for the moderate wing to take over. Will we see that in South Carolina?
I think that's true. I don't know that I would put Rubio in the moderate wing. But I think he, you know, I guess compared to Cruz, he's probably a little bit more. I was reading a story today about how he keeps taking different stands on the issues depending on what month it is. But I do think that that's true, that the moderates are being completely split up. I think one reason Rubio did well in Iowa is that their caucuses, you can vote for your second choice. You know, if your first choice, you know, if you were for who was, you know, Santorum or somebody, and they didn't get enough, you could move over to your second choice. And Rubio was a lot of people's second choice.
So we got a couple of minutes left here, and I want to go into something that I think is in your wheelhouse, Mary Newsom, and that is growth, because growth is a never-ending story here in Charlotte. And there was a story yesterday about a place called Radio Center. Now, I've seen this place since 1985 when I moved here. It's on South Boulevard, and I've always wondered, what is that? And why is it called Radio Center? And it's soon to be replaced by, surprise, surprise, a grocery store. So what's the story behind Radio Center?
I only know enough to be dangerous. I read that wonderful piece by Heather Mims, who I remember from the Observer Newsroom. I had no idea there were apartments back there.
I didn't either. I had no idea.
But
no
it's
clue.
Just, you know, you drive past it, as those of us who've lived here for a while have done for years. It's this really funky-looking, great little set of buildings. They look just like totally 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hate to think that they're going to be demolished, but you know they're going to be demolished because there's nothing that prevents the owner from selling and making money.
Well, I was told that once it was the home of Big Ways Radio, back when Big Ways was a major player in this market at 6:10 a.m. Is that why it's called Radio Center?
That would be my guess.
Okay. All right. Do we lose anything if it goes away? What do we lose? It's like losing the 21 Drive-In or the Queens Theater sign on South Boulevard. What do we lose?
Well, I think you can make the argument that this one little set of buildings, you don't lose anything. But I think you have a situation of death by 1,000 cuts. And every one of these little funky old buildings, wherever they are, could turn into a coffee shop, or a neat little store or a paper skyscraper. And you lose the totality of those affordable spaces. Old buildings are affordable spaces. People forget that piece of the picture.
We have 30 seconds, and this week it was reported that this construction on the widening of Independence Boulevard has stopped. Should we be worried about that, or will it quickly resume given the importance of that project?
From the sound of it, it sounds like we should be worried. It sounds like the contractor has basically walked off the job, and that's never a good thing.
But then again, delays in construction on Independence Boulevard, it's a Charlotte tradition.
Oh, yeah, that it is.
Well, they've been widening that road for 26 years now. Think about that. Thank you for being with us today, Mary Newsom, Associate Director of UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, Eric Frazier, Editorial Writer with the Charlotte Observer, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Thanks.
Thank you. Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.